everybody. My name is Maggie. You are listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Got a great co-host with me. His name's Matt Rothschild. You can find his podcast, Wisconsin Forward, on the Civic Media website, Spotify, and Apple Pods. Check it out. I know I give a listen to it. Whenever he comes out with a new episode, we've got a fine guest with us, Professor Howard Schwaber. He's with the University of Wisconsin, Madison, political scientist, attorney. We're helping to unpack not just Stephen Miller's sort of nonsense bomb from Friday afternoon, but more broadly, this is a very typical and highly consequential pattern in the Trump administration. That is, to make an argument or take a policy action and then justify it with pretty much an A to Z litany of all arguments that are incorrect. At the same time, do all kinds of things. So the things that they're doing, the policy, so much, so fast, all wrongly justified, so that people who are trying to debunk that and respond to it can hardly keep up. Professor Schwaber, before we went to break at the bottom of the hour, you discussed this as a specific tactic. And ultimately, there is an intersection with the Supreme Court and how the court will handle these cases bubbling up through the circuit courts. But let's talk about it a bit as a policy strategy and a legal strategy and tactic. How have you been viewing this since the administration's blunderbuss approach first blew up on January 21st?
Yeah, you left out, it's also a political tactic.
Yes.
Right, so there's so much to talk about here. It goes back to a famous comment by Steve Bannon some time ago, flood the zone with stuff, although that's not the word that he used. There have been 200 judicial rulings putting a hold on Trump administration actions in 128 cases. There we go. In 43 cases, policies have been approved, and there are 140 more which we're still waiting for rulings. Those numbers are bizarre. And the Trump administration makes use of that fact. Look, we've had more injunctions than any presidency in history. This proves the judiciary is out of control. Of course, it proves nothing of the sort. What it proves is that the Trump administration has very deliberately pushed the boundaries of the court system's capacity. There is no possibility that the U.S. Supreme Court can rule on 200 lower court rulings between now and the end of May. It's not going to happen. It can't. I just saw a story today about a court of appeals putting a hold on an injunction by a lower court. It doesn't matter what the topic was. You can read one of these stories
every day.
Yeah. And the court system works slowly. It's designed to. One of the strategies the Trump administration has taken on is to deliberately do an enormous range of things that are unlawful. And I should come back to that in a second. Knowing that there's no way that the Congress is not willing to stop them because it's dominated by Republicans, and the courts simply can't. Courts are effective potential constraints, but they move slowly. It'll be next year, you know, or after the war is over, in the case of Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War, that we finally get a statement. In the meantime, people are sitting in jail cells. Secondly, politically, from January 21st, I've been watching this closely, and it fascinates me. Every time the Trump administration has a victory, they move the goalposts. That is, they take a more extreme position. In politics, there's a phrase, the Overton window, which is just a cute phrase for what is a plausible argument. In legal terms, it's the on-the-wall versus off-the-wall legal arguments. And as the window moves, right, what counts as normal moves. So a position that was once extreme is now normal, and so on. Miller's comment about habeas corpus that we were talking about, I don't think he would have said that in February. I think this is a matter of him moving the goalposts, saying something more extreme, because between then and now, they've laid some groundwork for declaring judges should be impeached and for declaring court should be closed down and for declaring, oh, we abide by the Supreme Court, but also declaring we don't need to abide by lower court judges. Coming back to something I alluded to earlier, one of the very core strategies of the Trump administration is to do things that are unlawful, that is, violate federal law, on the grounds that they think that those laws are unconstitutional by their particular theory, and they're waiting for the Supreme Court to say so. I know we don't have time for this, but the name of the theory is the unitary executive. That's a strat. So we have three strategies. One is flood the zone. One is deliberately violate laws that you think are contrary to your constitutional philosophy and think you won the Supreme Court. And one is move the window of what's remotely acceptable political rhetoric by constantly pushing the goalposts in more and more extreme directions. I think we should start calling it the internet or the cyberspace form of political discourse, right? Think of an algorithm. Mm-hmm. All those three things are going on, and all of them meet in this discussion about habeas corpus.
Professor Schwaber, I appreciate that analysis. It's like they want to get one fait accompli after another, and they're moving the discussion ever into more dangerous territory. But I just want to put a bow on our discussion here, Stephen Miller, or two bows. The first bow is, look, neither Congress nor the president can overrule the Constitution. That's been a doctrine here in the United States for 200 years, Marbury versus Madison. Number two, this isn't just Stephen Miller sticking his neck out, because CNN has a report saying President Donald Trump has been personally involved in discussions inside the administration over potentially suspending habeas corpus. And then they quote something from Trump on April 30th, where he says there are ways to mitigate bad decisions on deportations, for instance, and there's some very strong ways to do it, Trump told reporters. There's one that's been used by three very highly respected presidents, but we hope we don't have to go that route. But there is one way used successfully by three presidents, he repeated, and hopefully we don't have to go that way, but there are ways of doing it. So, you know, this is obviously on Trump's mind that they'll just unilaterally say habeas corpus out the window. It's crazy.
Oh, there's no question. Look, we've been talking about Stephen Miller because he made the quotation to the press that caught the attention, but he doesn't make this stuff up on his own. I don't think Trump is a great theorist who comes up with these ideas, but he hears something that strikes his fancy, and he repeats it. Famously, whoever the last person in the room was, and famously, Miller is lately the last person in the room. Let's not even get into that sort of psychodynamic of the Trump White House. You need a different expert. I'll be honest, I wouldn't listen to that show. I just couldn't. But let me back up a second, because there are some big points here. First, we ought not to pretend that habeas corpus is some sort of, I should have had a good metaphor, I don't, I'm sorry, some inviolate principle that has never been questioned before. Over the last 20 years, the U.S. Supreme Court has dramatically weakened habeas corpus protections for criminal defendants, for example. The conditions, the timing, and the grounds on which people, even facing the death penalty, can bring habeas corpus petitions have been narrowed repeatedly and consistently by conservative justices, and especially by the Roberts Court. Secondly, one of the presidents, to whom Trump may have been referring, I don't know, who tried to narrow habeas corpus was George W. Bush. And in that case, the U.S. Supreme Court actually pushed back. There were three cases involving detainees held at Guantanamo. The most famous is Boumediene versus Bush, but there are three of them. And taken together, they stood for the proposition that neither the president nor Congress, which is important, could simply take habeas corpus away altogether for an entire class of defendants. But Congress can, and in the past has, limited habeas corpus. So, you know, again, the U.S. Supreme Court is not a great champion of habeas corpus in our lifetime. Congress has a history of trying to, sometimes successfully, sometimes not, stopped by the courts, stripping habeas corpus. The one proposition that makes this all so extraordinarily radical is that a president, and to be fair, George W. Bush did try to assert the same thing, but was slapped down, is that a president acting on his own initiative can unilaterally declare whether habeas corpus applies or not just because he says so. Earlier in the broadcast, I used a very, very loaded term. I used the term tyrant. I was recently rereading the Declaration of Independence. I know this gets to be kind of, do we really need such overheated references? And we don't. But it is the point is worth making that an individual government official with the power to unilaterally declare that people can be seized without any opportunity of a hearing of any kind is getting really close to the model of rule that the American constitutional system is entirely designed to resist.
Entirely designed to resist.
Yeah, no, I'll stand with that.
Yeah, I have been struggling, Professor, to find that phrase for a long time, right? contrary, antithetical to our foundational principles, the very principles, the values outlined in the Declaration of Independence. Ironically, of course, the suspension clause was in the Constitution, which was written before the various different constitutional documents like the Bill of Rights. But this is where we're at. It is contrary to the very principles that our country was founded upon.
Forgive me for interrupting, but you just
please
alluded to me that's really important. The Constitution does not declare the principle habeas corpus. It declares a suspension clause. The principle was so taken for granted, so fundamental, so part of the background of understanding that the thing the Constitution specified was the limited circumstances and mechanism by which you could ever not
have it. It's so critical, just to reemphasize what the Constitution, it presumes the constant existence of habeas, habeas corpus. So it only specifies when it can be suspended, and it is limited. The framers were deeply, deeply concerned about this particular element. As someone who grew up studying Central and South American governments, U.S. Interventions therein throughout the 70s and 80s. Someone getting disappeared, very much a thing that I spent quite a bit of time studying that was alarming to me. Never did I think it would be a possibility. Here, we've got Professor Howard Schwaber from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I've got guest co-host Matt Rothschild. We could spend all day on this, Professor. It is endlessly important, both important and interesting. I do want to ask you about another constitutional provision, which, I mean, silly me, I thought almost anyone could read and understand what it means. But apparently we've got some confusion on this point. And that is this fancy word, emoluments, and the emoluments clause. Tell people what it is, and then we'll get to why it's so important today.
Yeah, so this is where you have to work really, really hard to not be cynical. The emoluments clause. So first of all, shame on you, Ms. Dawn, for the foolish presumption that you can simply read words and know what they mean. That's not how lawyers work. The emoluments clause is a clause in the Constitution which has a really simple purpose. A president may not accept gifts. And the reason that could not be more obvious, a president should not be subjected to foreign bribery. And the circumstances and context could not be more obvious. European history was full of kings and emperors receiving lavish gifts of treasure. You ever seen the movie The Maltese Falcon? Tribute, it was called. And we didn't want to have that. I see we're on a break. I'll happily pick this up when we come back.
Yeah. Again, I can just turn over the keys to the show. We've got Professor Howard Schwaber with us, who knows how to anticipate a little time out of breath, if we will, here. This is a short one, ladies and gentlemen, so you're going to want to come right back with us. What about that beautiful luxury hotel in the sky? Does that run afoul of the emoluments clause? We discuss next. My name's Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network.